Today we will be reading Chapter 35, America in World War II. The United States was plunged into the inferno of World War II with the most stupefying and humiliating military defeat in its history. In the dismal months that ensued, the democratic world teetered on the edge of disaster. Japan's fanatics forgot that whoever stabs a king must stab to kill. A wounded but still potent American giant pulled itself out of the mud of Pearl Harbor, grimly determined to avenge the bloody treachery. "Get Japan first," was the cry that rose from millions of infuriated Americans, especially on the Pacific coast. These outraged souls regarded America's share in the global conflict as a private war of vengeance in the Pacific, with the European front a kind of holding operation. But Washington, in the so-called ABC One agreement with the British, had earlier and wisely adopted the grand strategy of getting Germany first. If America diverted its main strength to the Pacific, Hitler might crush both the Soviet Union and Britain and then emerge unconquerable in Fortress Europe. But if Germany was knocked out first, the combined Allied forces could be concentrated on Japan, and its daring game of conquest would be up. Meanwhile, just enough American strength would be sent to the Pacific to prevent Japan from digging in too deeply. The Get Germany First strategy was the solid foundation on which all American military strategy was built, but it encountered much ignorant criticism from two-fisted Americans who thirsted for revenge against Japan. Aggrieved protests were also registered by shorthanded American commanders in the Pacific and by Chinese and Australian allies. But President Roosevelt, a competent strategist in his own right, wisely resisted these pressures. The Allies trade space for time. Given time, the Allies seemed bound to triumph, but would they be given time? True, they had on their side the great mass of the world's population, but the wolf is never intimidated by the number of the sheep. The United States was the mightiest military power on earth, potentially. But wars are won with bullets, not with blueprints. Indeed, America came perilously close to losing the war to the well-armed aggressors before it could begin to throw its full weight onto the scales. Time, in a sense, was the most needed munition. Expense was no limitation. The overwhelming problem confronting America was to retool itself for all-out war production, while praying that the dictators would not meanwhile crush their adversaries who still remained in the field, notably Britain and the Soviet Union. Haste was all the more imperative because the highly skilled German scientists might turn up with unbeatable secret weapons, including rocket bombs and perhaps even atomic arms. America's task was far more complex and backbreaking than during World War I. It had to feed, clothe, and arm itself, as well as transport its forces to regions as far separated as Britain and Burma. More than that, it had to send a vast amount of food and munitions to its hard-pressed allies, who stretched all the way from the USSR to Australia. Could the American people, reputedly gone soft, measure up to this Herculean task? Was democracy rotten and decadent, as the dictators sneeringly proclaimed? The shock of war. National unity was no worry, thanks to the electrifying blows by the Japanese at Pearl Harbor. American communists had denounced the Anglo-French imperialist war before Hitler attacked Stalin in 1941, but they now clamored for an unmitigated assault on the Axis powers. The handful of strutting pro-Hitlerites in the United States melted away, while millions of Italian-Americans and German-Americans loyally supported the nation's war program. In contrast to World War I, when the patriotism of millions of immigrants was hotly questioned, World War II actually speeded the assimilation of many ethnic groups into American society. Immigration had been choked off for almost two decades before 1941, and America's ethnic communities were now composed of well-settled members whose votes were crucial to Franklin Roosevelt's Democratic Party. Consequently, there was virtually no government witch-hunting of minority groups, as had happened in World War I. A painful exception was the plight of some 110,000 Japanese Americans concentrated on the Pacific coast. The Washington top command, fearing that they might act as saboteurs for Japan in case of invasion, forcibly herded them together in concentration camps, though about two-thirds of them were American-born U.S. citizens. This brutal precaution was both unnecessary and unfair. as the loyalty and combat record of Japanese Americans proved to be admirable. But a wave of post-Pearl Harbor hysteria, backed by the long historical swell of anti-Japanese prejudice on the West Coast, temporarily robbed many Americans of their good sense and their sense of justice. The internment camps deprived these uprooted Americans of dignity and basic rights. The internees also lost hundreds of millions of dollars in property and foregone earnings. The wartime Supreme Court in 1944 upheld the constitutionality of the Japanese relocation in Korematsu versus U.S. But more than four decades later, in 1988, the U.S. government officially apologized for its actions and approved the payment of reparations of $20,000 to each camp survivor. The war prompted other changes in the American mood. Many programs of the once popular New Deal, including the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Works Progress Administration, and the National Youth Administration, were wiped out by the conservative Congress elected in 1942. Roosevelt declared in 1943 that Dr. New Deal was going into retirement to be replaced by Dr. Win the War. His announcement acknowledged not only the urgency of the war effort, but the power of the revitalized conservative forces in the country. The era of the New Deal reform was over. World War II was no idealistic crusade as World War I had been. The Washington government did make some effort to propagandize at home and abroad with the Atlantic Charter, but the accent was on action. Opinion polls in 1942 revealed that 9 out of 10 Americans could cite no provisions of the Atlantic Charter. A majority then, and near majority 2 years later, confessed to having no clear idea what the war was about. All Americans knew was that they had a dirty job on their hands and that the only way out was forward. They went about their bloody task with astonishing efficiency. Building the war machine. The war crisis caused the drooping American economy to snap to attention. Massive military orders, over $100 billion in 1942 alone, almost instantly soaked up the idle industrial capacity of the still lingering Great Depression. Orchestrated by the War Production Board, American factories poured forth an avalanche of weaponry. 40 billion bullets, 300,000 aircraft, 76,000 ships, 86,000 tanks, and 2.6 million machine guns. Miracle Man shipbuilder Henry J. Kaiser was dubbed Sir Launcelot for his prodigies of ship construction. One of his ships was fully assembled in 14 days, complete with life jackets and coat hangers. The War Production Board halted the manufacture of non-essential items such as passenger cars. It assigned priorities for transportation and access to raw materials. When the Japanese invasion of British Malaya and the Dutch East Indies snapped America's lifeline of natural rubber, the government imposed a national speed limit and gasoline rationing in order to conserve rubber and build 51 synthetic rubber plants. By war's end, they were far outproducing the pre-war supply. Farmers, too, rolled up their sleeves and increased their output. The armed forces drained the farms of workers, but heavy new investment in agricultural machinery and improved fertilizers more than made up for the difference. In 1944 and 1945, blue-jeaned farmers hauled in record-breaking billion-bushel wheat harvests. These wonders of production also brought economic strains. Full employment and scarce consumer goods fueled a sharp inflationary surge in 1942. The Office of Price Administration eventually brought ascending prices under control with extensive regulations. Rationing held down the consumption of critical goods such as meat and butter, though some black marketeers and meatleggers cheated the system. The War Labor Board, WLB, imposed ceilings on wage increases. Labor unions, whose membership grew from about 10 million to more than 13 million workers during the war, fiercely resented the government-dictated wage ceilings. Despite the no-strike pledges of most of the major unions, a rash of labor walkouts plagued the war effort. Prominent among the strikers were the United Mine Workers, who several times were called off the job by their crusty and iron-willed chieftain, John L. Lewis. Threats of lost production through strikes became so worrisome that Congress, in June 1943, passed the Smith-Connelly Anti-Strike Act. This act authorized the federal government to seize and operate tied-up industries. Strikes against any government-operated industry were made a criminal offense. Under the act, Washington took over the coal mines and, for a brief period, the railroads. Yet work stoppages, although dangerous, actually accounted for less than 1% of the total working hours of the United States wartime laboring force, a record better than blockaded Britain's. American workers, on the whole, were commendably committed to the war effort. Manpower and womanpower. The armed services enlisted nearly 15 million men in World War II and some 216,000 women, who were employed for non-combat duties. Best known of these women in arms were the WAAC's Army, WAVES, Navy, and SPARS in the Coast Guard. As the draft net was tightened after Pearl Harbor, millions of young men were plucked from their homes and clothed in GI, government issue, outfits. As the arsenal of democracy, the United States exempted certain key categories of industrial and agricultural workers from the draft in order to keep its mighty industrial and food-producing machines humming. But even with these exemptions, the draft left the nation's farms and factories so short of personnel that new workers had to be found. An agreement with Mexico in 1942 brought thousands of Mexican agricultural workers called braceros across the border to harvest the fruit and grain crops of the West. The bracero program outlived the war by some 20 years, becoming a fixed feature of the agricultural economy in many Western states. Even more dramatic was the march of women onto the factory floor. More than 6 million women took up jobs outside the home. Over half of them had never before worked for wages. Many of them were mothers, and the government was obliged to set up some 3,000 daycare centers to care for Rosie the Riveter's children while she drilled the fuselage of a heavy bomber or joined the links of a tank track. When the war ended, Rosie and many of her sisters were in no hurry to put down their tools. They wanted to keep on working, and often did. The war thus foreshadowed an eventual revolution in the roles of women in the American society. Yet the war's immediate impact on women's lives has frequently been exaggerated. The great majority of American women, especially those with husbands present in the home or with small children to care for, did not work for wages in the wartime economy, but continued in their traditional roles. In both Britain and the Soviet Union, a far greater percentage of women, including mothers, were pressed into industrial employment as the gods of war laid a much heavier hand on those societies than they did on the United States. A poll in 1943 revealed that a majority of American women would not take a job in a war plant if it were offered. At war's end, 2/3 of women war workers left the labor force. Many of them were forced out of their jobs by employers and unions eager to reemploy returning servicemen. But half of them told census takers that they quit their jobs voluntarily because of family obligations. The immediate post-war period witnessed not a permanent widening of women's employment opportunities, but a widespread rush into suburban domesticity and the mothering of the baby boomers, who were born by the tens of millions in the decade and a half after 1945. America was destined to experience a thoroughgoing revolution in women's status later in the post-war period, but that epical change was only beginning to gather momentum in the war years. Wartime migrations. The war also proved to be a demographic cauldron, churning and shifting the American population. Many of the 15 million men and women in uniform, having seen new sights and glimpsed new horizons, chose not to go home again at war's end. War industry sucked people into boom towns like Los Angeles, Detroit, Seattle, and Baton Rouge. California's population grew by nearly 2 million. The South experienced especially dramatic changes. Franklin Roosevelt had called the South the nation's number one economic problem in 1938. When war came, he seized the opportunity to accelerate the region's economic development. The states of the old Confederacy received a disproportionate share of defense contracts, including nearly $6 billion of federally financed industrial facilities. Here were the seeds of the post-war blossoming of the Sun Belt. Despite this economic stimulus in the South, Some 1.6 million blacks left the land of their ancient enslavement to seek jobs in the war plants of the West and North. Forever after, since race relations constituted a national, not a regional issue, explosive tensions developed over employment, housing, and segregated facilities. Black leader A. Philip Randolph, head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, threatened a massive Negro march on Washington in 1941 to demand equal opportunities for blacks in war jobs and in the armed forces. Roosevelt's response was to issue an executive order forbidding discrimination in defense industries. In addition, the president established the Fair Employment Practices Commission, FEPC, to monitor compliance with his edict. Blacks were also drafted into the armed forces, though they were still generally assigned to service branches rather than combat units and subjected to petty degradations such as segregated blood banks for the wounded. But in general, the war helped to embolden blacks in their long struggle for equality. They rallied behind the slogan Double V, victory over the dictators abroad and over racism at home. Membership in the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, shot up almost to the half-million mark, and a new militant organization, the Congress of Racial Equality, was founded in 1942. The northward migration of African Americans accelerated after the war thanks to the advent of the mechanical cotton picker, an invention whose impact rivaled that of Eli Whitney's cotton gin. Introduced in 1944, this new mechanical marvel did the work of 50 people at about one-eighth the cost. Overnight, the Cotton South's historic need for cheap labor disappeared. Their muscle no longer required in Dixie, some 5 million black tenant farmers and sharecroppers headed north in the three decades after the war. Theirs was one of the great migrations in American history, comparable in size to the immigrant floods from Ireland, Italy, and Poland. Within a single generation, a near majority of African Americans gave up their historic homeland and their rural way of life. By 1970, half of all blacks lived outside the South, and urban had become almost a synonym for black. The speed and scale of these changes jolted the migrants and sometimes convulsed the communities that received them. The war also prompted an exodus of Native Americans from the reservations. Thousands of Indian men and women found war work in the major cities, and thousands more answered Uncle Sam's call to arms. More than 90% of Indians resided on reservations in 1940. 6 decades later, more than half of them lived in cities with a large concentration in Southern California. Some 25,000 Native American men served in the armed forces. Comanches in Europe and Navajos in the Pacific made especially valuable contributions as code talkers. They transmitted radio messages in their native languages, which were incomprehensible to the Germans and the Japanese. The sudden rubbing against one another of unfamiliar peoples produced some distressingly violent friction. In 1943, young zoot-clad Mexicans and Mexican-Americans in Los Angeles were viciously attacked by Anglo sailors who cruised the streets in taxicabs searching for victims. Order was restored only after the Mexican ambassador made an emotional plea, pointing out that such outbreaks were grist for Nazi propaganda mills. At almost the same time, an even more brutal race riot that killed 25 blacks and 9 whites erupted in Detroit, holding the home front. Despite these ugly episodes, Americans on the home front suffered little from the war compared to the peoples of the other fighting nations. By war's end, much of the planet was a smoking ruin. But in America, the war invigorated the economy and lifted the country out of a decade-long depression. The gross national product vaulted from less than $100 billion in 1940 to more than $200 billion in 1945. Corporate profits rose from about $6 billion in 1940 to almost twice that amount 4 years later. If you were going to try to go to war in a capitalist country, said Secretary of War Henry Stimson, you have to let business make money out of the process or business won't work. Despite wage ceilings, overtime pay, fattened pay envelopes, disposable personal income, even after payment of wartime taxes, more than doubled. On December 7, 1944, the third anniversary of Pearl Harbor, Macy's department store rang up the biggest sales day in its history. Americans had never had it so good, and they wanted it a lot better. When price controls were finally lifted in 1946, America's pent-up lust to consume pushed prices up 33% in less than 2 years. The rest of the world, meanwhile, was still clawing its way out from under the rubble of war. The hand of government touched more American lives more intimately during the war than ever before. The war, perhaps even more than the New Deal, pointed the way to post-1945 era of big government interventionism. Every household felt the constraints of the rationing system. Millions of men and women worked for Uncle Sam in the armed forces. Millions more worked for him in the defense industries, where their employers and unions were monitored by the FEPC and the WLB, and their personal needs were cared for by government-sponsored housing projects, daycare facilities, and health plans. The Office of Scientific Research and Development channeled hundreds of millions of dollars into university-based scientific research, establishing the partnership between the government and universities that underwrote America's technological and economic leadership in the post-war era. The flood of war dollars, not the relatively modest rivulet of New Deal spending, at last swept the plague of unemployment from the land. War, not enlightened social policy, cured the Depression. As the post-war economy continued to depend dangerously on military spending for its health, many observers looked back to the years 1941 to 1945 as the origins of a warfare welfare state. The conflict was phenomenally expensive. The wartime bill amounted to more than $330 billion, 10 times the direct cost of World War I, and twice as much as all previous spending since 1776. Roosevelt would have preferred to follow a pay-as-you-go policy to finance the war, but the costs were simply too gigantic. The income tax net was expanded to catch about four times as many people as before, and maximum tax rates rose as high as 90%. But despite such drastic measures, only about two-fifths of the war costs were paid from current revenues. The remainder was borrowed. The national debt skyrocketed from $49 billion in 1941 to $259 billion in 1945. When production finally slipped into high gear, the war was costing about $10 million an hour. This was the price of victory over such implacable enemies, the rising sun in the Pacific. Early success of the efficient Japanese militarists were breathtaking. They realized that they would have to win quickly or lose slowly. Seldom, if ever, has so much territory been conquered so rapidly with so little loss. Simultaneously with the assault on Pearl Harbor, the Japanese launched widespread and uniformly successful attacks on various Far East bastions. These included the American outposts of Guam, Wake, and the Philippines. In a dismayingly short time, the Japanese invader seized not only the British Chinese port of Hong Kong, but also British Malaya, with its critically important supplies of rubber and tin. Nor did the Japanese tide stop there. The overambitious soldiers of the emperor, plunging into the snake-infested jungles of Burma, cut the famed Burma Road. This was the route over which the United States had been trucking a trickle of munitions to the armies of the Chinese Generalissimo, Chiang Kai-shek, Chiang Kai-shek, who was still resisting the Japanese invader in China. Thereafter, intrepid American aviators were forced to fly a handful of war supplies to Chiang over the hump of the towering Himalaya Mountains from the India-Burma theater. Meanwhile, the Japanese had lunged southward against the oil-rich Dutch East Indies. The jungle-matted islands speedily fell to the assailants after the combined British, Australian, Dutch, and American naval and air forces had been smashed at an early date by their numerically superior foe. Better news came from the Philippines, which succeeded dramatically in slowing down the Mikado's warriors for 5 months. The Japanese promptly landed a small but effective army, and General Douglas MacArthur, the eloquent and egotistical American commander, withdrew to a strong defensive position at Bataan, not far from Manila. There, about 20,000 American troops, supported by a much larger force of ill-trained Filipinos, held off violent Japanese attacks until April 9, 1942. The defenders, reduced to eating mules and monkeys, heroically traded their lives for time in the face of hopeless odds. They grimly joked while vainly hoping for reinforcements. "We're the battling bastards of Bataan. No mama, no papa, no Uncle Sam." Before the inevitable American surrender, General MacArthur was ordered by Washington to depart secretly for Australia, there to head the resistance against the Japanese. Leaving by motorboat and airplane, he proclaimed, "I shall return." After the battered remnants of his army had hoisted the white flag, they were treated with vicious cruelty in the infamous 80-mile Bataan death march to prisoner of war camps, first in a series of atrocities committed by both sides in the unusually savage Pacific War. The island fortress of Corregidor in Manila Harbor held out until May 6, 1942, when it too surrendered and left Japanese forces in complete control of the Philippine archipelago. Japan's high tide at Midway. The aggressive warriors from Japan, making hay while the rising sun shone, pushed relentlessly southward. They invaded the turtle-shaped island of New Guinea, north of Australia, and landed on the Solomon Islands, from which they threatened Australia itself. Their onrush was finally checked by a crucial naval battle fought in the Coral Sea in May 1942. An American carrier task force, with Australian support, inflicted heavy losses on the victory-flushed Japanese. For the first time in history, the fighting was all done by carrier-based aircraft, and neither fleet saw or fired a shot directly at the other. Japan next undertook to seize Midway Island, more than 1,000 miles northwest of Honolulu. From this strategic base, it could launch devastating assaults on Pearl Harbor and perhaps force the weakened American Pacific Fleet into destructive combat, possibly even compel the United States to negotiate a ceasefire in the Pacific. An epical naval battle was fought near Midway on June 3rd through 6, 1942. Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, a high-grade naval strategist, directed a smaller but skillfully maneuvered carrier force under Admiral Raymond A. Spruance against the powerful invading fleet. The fighting was all done by aircraft, and the Japanese broke off action after losing four vitally important carriers. Midway was a pivotal victory. Combined with the Battle of the Coral Sea, the U.S. success at Midway halted Japan's juggernaut. But the thrust of the Japanese into the Eastern Pacific did net them America's fogged islands of Kiska and Attu in the Aleutian Archipelago off Alaska. This easy conquest aroused a fear of invasion of the United States from the Northwest. Much American strength was consequently diverted to the defense of Alaska, including the construction of the Alcan Highway through Canada. Yet the Japanese imperialists, overextended in 1942, suffered from victory disease. Their appetites were bigger than their stomachs. If they had only dug in and consolidated their gains, they would have been much more difficult to dislodge once the tide turned. American leapfrogging toward Tokyo. Following the heartening victory at Midway, the United States for the first time was able to seize the initiative in the Pacific. In August 1942, American ground forces gained a toehold on the Guadalcanal Island in the Solomons in an effort to protect the lifeline from America to Australia through the Southwest Pacific. An early naval defeat inflicted by the Japanese shortened American supplies dangerously, and for weeks the U.S. troops held on to the malarial island only by their fingernails. After several desperate sea battles for naval control, the Japanese troops evacuated Guadalcanal in February 1943. Japanese losses were 20,000 compared to 1,700 for the Americans. That casualty ratio of more than 10 to 1, Japanese to American, persisted throughout the Pacific War. American on Australia forces under General MacArthur, meanwhile, had been hanging on courageously to the southeastern tip of New Guinea, the last buffer protecting Australia. The scales of war gradually began to tip as the American Navy, including submarines, inflicted lethal losses on Japanese supply ships and troop carriers. conquest of the north coast of New Guinea was completed by August 1944, after General MacArthur had fought his way westward through tropical jungle hells. This hard-won victory was the first leg on his long return journey to the Philippines. The U.S. Navy, with Marines and Army divisions doing the meat grinder fighting, had meanwhile been leapfrogging the Japanese-held islands in the Pacific. Old-fashioned strategy dictated that the American forces, as they drove toward Tokyo, should reduce the fortified Japanese outposts on their flank. This, of course, would have taken many blood-stained months, for the Holden defenders were prepared to die to the last man in their caves. The new strategy of island hopping called for bypassing some of the most heavily fortified Japanese posts, capturing nearby islands, setting up airfields on them, and then neutralizing the enemy bases through heavy bombing. Deprived of essential supplies from the homeland, Japan's outposts would slowly wither on the vine, as they did. Brilliant success crowned the American attacks on the Japanese island strongholds in the Pacific, where Admiral Nimitz skillfully coordinated the efforts of naval, air, and ground units. In May and August of 1943, Attu and Kiska in the Aleutians were easily retaken. In November 1943, Bloody Tarawa and Macon, both in the Gilbert Islands, fell after suicidal resistance. In January and February 1944, the key outpost of the Marshall Islands group succumbed after savage fighting. Especially prized were the Marianas, including America's conquered Guam. From bases in the Marianas, the United States' new B-29 superbombers could carry out round-trip bombing raids on Japan's home islands. The assault on the Marianas opened on June 19, 1944, with what American pilots called the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot. A combination of the combat superiority of the recently developed American Hellcat fighter plane and the new technology of the anti-aircraft proximity fuse destroyed nearly 250 Japanese aircraft with a loss of only 29 American planes. The following day, in the Battle of the Philippine Sea, U.S. naval forces sank several Japanese carriers. The Japanese Navy never recovered from these massive losses of planes, pilots, and ships. After fanatical resistance, including a mass suicide leap of surviving Japanese soldiers and civilians from Suicide Cliff on Saipan, the major island of the Marianas fell to the U.S. attackers in July and August 1944. With these unsinkable aircraft carriers now available, virtual round-the-clock bombing of Japan began in November 1944. The Allied halting of Hitler. Early setbacks for America in the Pacific were paralleled in the Atlantic. Hitler had entered the war with a formidable fleet of ultra-modern submarines, which ultimately operated in wolf packs with frightful effect, especially in the North Atlantic, the Caribbean, and the Gulf of Mexico. During 10 months of 1942, more than 500 merchant ships were reported lost, 111 in June alone, as ship destruction far outran construction. The tide of subsea battle turned with agonizing slowness. Old techniques such as escorting convoys of merchant vessels and dropping depth bombs from destroyers were strengthened by air patrol, the newly invented technology of radar, and the bombing of submarine bases. "Keep 'em sailing" was the motto of oil-begrimed merchant seamen, hundreds of whom perished as unsung heroes in icy seas. Eventually, Allied anti-submarine tactics improved substantially, thanks to British codebreakers who had cracked the Germans' Enigma codes and could therefore pinpoint the locations of the U-boats lurking in the North Atlantic. Not until the spring of 1943 did the Allies clearly have the upper hand against the U-boat. If they had not won the Battle of the Atlantic, Britain would have been forced under, and a second front could not have been launched from its island springboard. Victory over the undersea raiders was nerve-wrackingly narrow. When the war ended, Hitler was about to mass-produce a fearsome new submarine, one that could remain underwater indefinitely and cruise at 17 knots when submerged. Meanwhile, the turning point of the land-air war against Hitler had come late in 1942. The British had launched a 1,000-plane raid on Cologne in May. In August 1942, they were joined by the American Air Force and were cascading bombs on German cities. The Germans under Marshal Erwin Rommel, the Desert Fox, had driven eastward across the hot sands of North Africa into Egypt, perilously close to the Suez Canal. A breakthrough would have spelled disaster for the Allies. But late in October 1942, British General Bernard Montgomery delivered a withering attack at El Alamein, west of Cairo. With the aid of several hundred hastily shipped American Sherman tanks, he speedily drove the enemy back to Tunisia, more than 1,000 miles away. On the Soviet front, the unexpected successes of the Red Army gave a new lift to the Allied cause. In September 1942, the Russians stalled the German steamroller at rubble-strewn Stalingrad, graveyard of Hitler's hopes. More than a score of invading divisions, caught in an icy noose, later surrendered or were mopped up. In November 1942, the resilient Russians unleashed a crushing counteroffensive, which was never seriously reversed. A year later, Stalin had regained about two-thirds of the blood-soaked Soviet motherland, wrested from him by the German invader. A second front from North America to Rome. Soviet losses were already staggering in 1942. Millions of soldiers and civilians lay dead, and Hitler's armies had overrun most of the Western USSR. Anglo-American losses at this time could be counted only in the thousands. By war's end, the grave had closed over some 20 million Soviets, and a great swath of their country, equivalent in the United States to the area from Chicago to the Atlantic seaboard, had been laid waste. Small wonder that Kremlin leaders clamored for a second front to divert the German strength westward. Many Americans, including FDR, were eager to begin a diversionary invasion of France in 1942 or 43. They feared that the Soviets, unable to hold out forever against Germany, might make a separate peace as they had in 1918 and leave the Western Allies to face Hitler's fury alone. Roosevelt rashly promised the Soviets in early 1942 that he would open a second front on the European continent by the end of the year, a promise that proved utterly impossible to keep. British military planners, remembering their appalling losses in 1914 to 1918, were not enthusiastic about a frontal assault on German-held France. It might end in disaster. They preferred to attack Hitler's fortress Europe through the soft underbelly of the Mediterranean. Faced with British boot-dragging and a woeful lack of resources, the Americans reluctantly agreed to postpone a massive invasion of Europe. An assault on the French-held North Africa was a compromised second front and a far cry from what the badly Soviets were demanding. The highly secret attack launched in November 1942 was headed by a gifted and easy-smiling American general, Dwight D. Ike Eisenhower. A master of organization and conciliation, as a joint Allied operation ultimately involving some 400,000 men, British, Canadian, French, and chiefly American, and about 850 ships, the invasion was the mightiest waterborne effort up to that time in history. After savage fighting, the remnants of the German-Italian army were finally trapped in Tunisia and surrendered in May 1943. New blows were now planned by the Allies. At Casablanca, in newly occupied French Morocco, President Roosevelt, who had boldly flown the Atlantic, met in a historic conference with Winston Churchill in January 1943. The Big Two agreed to step up the Pacific War, invade Sicily, increase pressure on Italy, and insist upon an unconditional surrender of the enemy, a phrase earlier popularized by General Ulysses S. Grant during the Civil War. Such an unyielding policy would presumably hearten the ultra-suspicious Soviets, who professed to fear separate Allied peace negotiations. It would also forestall charges of broken armistice terms, such as had come after 1918. Paradoxically, the tough-sounding, unconditional surrender declaration was an admission of the weakness of the Western Allies. Still unable in 1943 to mount the kind of second front their Soviet partner desperately demanded, the British and the Americans had little but words to offer Stalin. Unconditional surrender proved to be one of the most controversial moves of the war. The main criticism was that it steeled the enemy to fight to a last bunker resistance while discouraging anti-war groups in Germany from revolting. Although there was some truth in these charges, no one can prove that unconditional surrender either shortened or lengthened the war. But by helping to destroy the German government utterly, the harsh policy immensely complicated the problems of post-war reconstruction. The Allied forces, victorious in Africa, now turned against the not-so-soft underbelly of Europe. Sicily fell in 1943 after sporadic but sometimes bitter resistance. Shortly before the conquest of the island, Mussolini was deposed and Italy surrendered unconditionally soon thereafter in September 1943. President Roosevelt, referring to the three original Axis countries, Germany, Italy, and Japan, joked grimly that it was now one down and two to go. But if Italy dropped out of the war, the Germans did not drop out of Italy. Hitler's well-trained troops stubbornly resisted the Allied invaders now pouring into the toe of the Italian boot. They also unleashed their fury against the Italians, who had turned their coats and declared war on Germany in October 1943. Sunny Italy proceeded to belie its name, for in the snow-covered and mud-caked mountains of the elongated peninsula occurred some of the filthiest, bloodiest, and most frustrating fighting of the war. For many months, Italy appeared to be a dead end, as the Allied advance was halted by a seemingly impregnable German defense centered on the ancient monastery of Monte Cassino. After a touch-and-go assault on the Anzio beachhead, Rome was finally taken on June 4, 1944. The tremendous cross-channel invasion of France, begun 2 days later, turned Italy into a kind of sideshow, but the Allies' limited manpower continued to fight their way slowly and painfully into northern Italy. On May 2, 1945, only 5 days before Germany's official surrender, several hundred thousand Axis troops in Italy laid down their arms and became prisoners of war. While the Italian Second Front opened the Mediterranean and diverted some German divisions from the blazing Soviet and French battle lines, it also may have delayed the main Allied invasion of Europe from England across the English Channel to France by many months, allowing more time for the Soviet army to advance into Eastern Europe. D-Day, June 6, 1944. The Soviets had never ceased their clamor for an all-out second front, and the time rapidly approached for Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin to meet in person to coordinate the promised effort. Marshal Joseph Stalin, with a careful eye on Soviet military operations, balked at leaving Moscow. President Roosevelt, who jauntily remarked in private, "I can handle that old buzzard," was eager to confer with him. The president seemed confident that Rooseveltian charm could woo the hardened conspirator of the Kremlin from his nasty communist ways. Tehran, the capital of Iran, or Persia, was finally chosen as the meeting place. To this ancient city, Roosevelt riskily flew, after a stopover conference in Cairo with Britain's Churchill and China's Jiang Zemin, regarding the war against Japan. At Tehran, the discussions among Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill from November 28th to December 1st progressed smoothly. Perhaps the most important achievement was an agreement on broad plans, especially for those launching Soviet attacks on Germany from the east simultaneously with the prospective Allied assault from the west. Preparations for the cross-channel invasion of France were gigantic. Britain's fast-anchored isle virtually groaned with munitions, supplies, and troops as nearly 3 million fighting men were readied. Because the United States was to provide most of the Allied warriors, the overall command was entrusted to an American, General Eisenhower. He had already distinguished himself in the North African and Mediterranean campaigns not only for his military capacity, but also for his gifts as a conciliator of clashing Allied interests. French Normandy, less heavily defended than other parts of the European coast, was pinpointed for the invasion assault. On D-Day, June 6, 1944, the enormous operation, which involved some 4,600 vessels, unwound. Stiff resistance was encountered from the Germans, who had been misled by a feint into expecting the blow to fall farther north. The Allies had already achieved mastery over the of the air over France. They were thus able to block reinforcements by crippling the railroads while worsening German fuel shortages by bombing gasoline-producing plants. The Allied beachhead, at first clung to with fingertips, was gradually enlarged, consolidated, and reinforced. After desperate fighting, the invaders finally broke out of the German iron ring that enclosed the Normandy landing zone. Most spectacular were the lunges across France by American armored divisions, brilliantly commanded by blustery and profane General George S. Blood and Guts Patton. The retreat of the German defenders was hastened when an American-French force landed in August 1944 on the southern coast of France and swept northward. With the assistance of the French underground, Paris was liberated in August 1944, amid exuberant manifestations of joy and gratitude. Allied forces rolled irresistibly toward Germany, and many of the Americans encountered places like Chateau Thierry, familiar to their fathers in 1918. Lafayette, we are here again, quipped some of the American soldiers. The first important German city, Aachen, fell to the Americans in October 1944, and the days of Hitler's thousand-year Reich were numbered. FDR, the fourth termite of 1944. The presidential campaign of 1944, which was bound to divert energy from the war program, came most awkwardly as the awful conflict roared to its climax. But the normal electoral processes continued to function, despite some loose talk of suspending them for the duration. Victory-starved Republicans met in Chicago with hopeful enthusiasm. They quickly nominated the short, mustachioed, and dapper Thomas E. Dewey, popular vote-getting governor of New York. Regarded as a liberal, he had already made a national reputation as a prosecutor of grafters and racketeers in New York City. His shortness and youth, he was only 42, had caused one veteran New Dealer to sneer that the candidate had cast his diaper into the ring. To offset Dewey's mild internationalism, the convention nominated for the vice president a strong isolationist, handsome and white-maned Senator John W. Bricker of Ohio. Yet the platform called for an unstinted prosecution of the war and for the creation of a new international organization to maintain peace. FDR, aging under the strain, was the indispensable man of the Democrats. No other major figure was available, and the war was apparently grinding to its finale. He was nominated at Chicago on the first ballot by acclamation, but in a sense he was the forgotten man of the convention, for in view of his age, an unusual amount of attention was focused on the vice presidency. The scramble for the vice presidential plum turned into something of a free-for-all. Henry A. Wallace, one-time Plowmunder Secretary of Agriculture, had served 4 years as vice president and desired a renomination, but conservative Democrats distrusted him as an ill-balanced and unpredictable liberal. A ditch Wallace move developed tremendous momentum despite the popularity of Wallace with large numbers of voters and many of the delegates. With Roosevelt's blessing, the vice presidential nomination finally went to smiling and self-assured Senator Harry S. Truman of Missouri, the new Missouri Compromise. Hitherto inconspicuous, he had recently attained national visibility as the efficient chairman of a Senate committee conducting an investigation of wasteful war expenditures. Nobody had much against him or on him. Roosevelt defeats Dewey. A dynamic Dewey took the offensive, for Roosevelt was too consumed with directing the war to spare much time for speechmaking. The vigorous young crime buster, with his beautiful baritone voice and polished diction, denounced the tired and quarrelsome old men in Washington. He proclaimed repeatedly that after 12 long years of New Dealism, it was time for a change. As for the war, Dewey would not alter the basic strategy, would fight it better, a type of Mentooism ridiculed by the Democrats. Me-tooism ridiculed by the Democrats. The fourth term issue did not figure prominently now that the ice had been broken by Roosevelt's third term, but dewy-eyed Republicans half-humorously professed to fear fifth and sixth terms by the lifer in the White House. In the closing weeks of the campaign, Roosevelt left his desk for the stump. He was stung by certain Republican charges, including criticism that he had sent a U.S. Navy destroyer to retrieve his pet Scotty dog, Fella. He was also eager to show himself, even in chilling rains, to spike well-founded rumors of failing health. Substantial assistance came from the new Political Action Committee of the CIO, which was organized to get around the law banning the direct use of union funds for political purposes. Zealous CIO members, branded as communists by the Republicans, rang countless doorbells and asked with pointed reference to the recent Depression, "What were you doing in 1932? At times, Roosevelt seemed to be running again against Hoover. As in every one of his previous three campaigns, FDR was opposed by a majority of the newspapers, which were chiefly owned by Republicans. Roosevelt, as customary, won a sweeping victory, 432-99 in the Electoral College, 25,606,585 to 22,014,745 in the popular vote. Elated, he quipped that the first 12 years are the hardest. Roosevelt won primarily because the war was going well. A winning pitcher is not ordinarily pulled from the game. Foreign policy was a decisive factor with untold thousands of voters who concluded that Roosevelt's experienced hand was needed in fashioning a future organization for world peace. The Dapper Dewey, cruelly dubbed the little man on top of the wedding cake, had spoken smoothly of international cooperation, but his isolationist running mate Bricker had implanted serious doubts. The Republican Party was still suffering from the taint of isolationism fastened on it by the Hardingites, the last days of Hitler. By mid-December 1944, the month after Roosevelt's fourth-term victory, Germany seemed to be wobbling on its last legs. The Soviet surge had penetrated eastern Germany, Allied aerial blockbuster bombs making the rubble bounce with around-the-clock attacks were falling like giant explosive hailstones on cities, factories, and transportation arteries. The German Western Front seemed about to buckle under the sledgehammer blows of the United States and its allies. Hitler then staked everything on one last throw of his reserves. Secretly concentrating a powerful force, he hurled it on December 16, 1944, against the thinly held American lines in the heavily befogged and snow-shrouded Ardennes Forest. His objective was the Belgian port of Antwerp, key to the Allied supply operation. Caught off guard, the outmanned Americans were driven back, creating a deep bulge in the Allied line. The 10-day penetration was finally halted after the 101st Airborne Division had stood firm at the vital bastion of Bastogne. The commander, Brigadier General A.C. McAuliffe, defiantly answered the German demand for the surrender with one word, nuts. Reinforcements were rushed up and the last gasp Hitlerian offensive was at length bloodily stemmed in the Battle of the Bulge. In March 1945, forward-driving American troops reached Germany's Rhine River, where, by incredibly good luck, they found one strategic bridge undemolished. Pressing their advantage, General Eisenhower's troops reached the Elbe River in April 1945. There, a short distance south of Berlin, American and Soviet guards dramatically clasped hands amid cries of "American comrades." The conquering Americans were horrified to find blood-spattered and still stinking concentration camps where the German Nazis had engaged in scientific mass murders of undesirables, including an estimated 6 million Jews. The Washington government had long been informed about Hitler's campaign of genocide against the Jews and had been reprehensibly slow to take steps against it. Roosevelt's administration had bolted the door against large numbers of Jewish refugees, and his military commanders declined even to bomb the rail lines that carried the victims to the camps. But until the war's end, the full dimensions of the Holocaust had not been known. When the details were revealed, the whole world was aghast. The vengeful Soviets clawed their way forward from the east, reached Berlin in April 1945. After desperate house-to-house fighting, followed by an orgy of pillage and rape, they captured the bomb-shattered city. Adolf Hitler, after a hasty marriage to his mistress, committed suicide in an underground bunker on April 30, 1945. Tragedy had meanwhile struck the United States. President Roosevelt, while relaxing at Warm Springs, Georgia, suddenly died from a massive cerebral hemorrhage on April 12, 1945. The crushing burden of 12 Depression and war years in the White House had finally taken its toll. Knots of confused, leaderless citizens gathered to discuss the future anxiously as a bewildered, unbriefed Vice President Truman took the helm. On May 7, 1945, what was left of German government surrendered unconditionally. May 8 was officially proclaimed VE, Victory in Europe Day, and was greeted with frenzied rejoicing in the Allied countries. Japan dies hard. Japan's rickety bamboo empire, meanwhile, was tottering to its fall. American submarines, the Silent Service, were sending the Japanese merchant marine to the bottom so fast they were running out of prey. All told, these undersea craft destroyed 1,042 ships, or about 50% of Japan's entire life-sustaining merchant fleet. Giant bomber attacks were more spectacular. Launched from Saipan and other captured Mariana Islands, they were reducing the enemy's fragile cities to cinders. The massive firebomb raid on Tokyo, March 9th and 10th, 1945, was annihilating. It destroyed over 250,000 buildings, gutted a quarter of the city, and killed an estimated 83,000 people, a loss comparable to that later inflicted by the atomic bombs. General MacArthur was also on the move. Completing the conquest of jungle-draped New Guinea, he headed northwest for the Philippines en route to Japan with 600 ships and 250,000 men. In a scene well staged for the photographers, he splashed ashore at Leyte Island on October 20, 1944, with the summons, "People of the Philippines, I have returned. Rally to me." Japan's navy, still menacing, now made one last-chance effort to destroy MacArthur by wiping out his transports and supply ships. A gigantic clash at Leyte Gulf, fought on the sea and in the air, was actually three battles, October 23 to 26, 1944. The Americans won all of them, though the crucial engagement was almost lost when Admiral William F. Bull Halsey was decoyed away by a feint. Japan was through as a sea power. It had lost about 60 ships in the greatest naval battle of all time. American fleets, numbering more than 4,000 vessels, now commanded the Western Pacific. Several battleships raised from the mud of Pearl Harbor were exacting, belated, but sweet revenge. Overrunning Leyte, MacArthur next landed on the main Philippine island of Luzon in January 1945. Manila was his major objective. The ravaged city fell in March, but the Philippines were not conquered until July. Victory was purchased only after bitter fighting against Holden Japanese, who took a toll of over 60,000 American casualties. America's steel vice was tightened mercilessly around Japan. The tiny island of Iwo Jima, needed as a haven for damaged American bombers returning from Japan, was captured in March 1945. This desperate 25-day assault cost over 4,000 American dead. Okinawa, a well-defended Japanese island, was next on the list. It was needed for closer bases from which to blast and burn enemy cities and industries. Fighting dragged on from April to June 1945. Japanese soldiers, fighting with incredible courage from their caves, finally sold Okinawa for 50,000 American casualties while suffering far heavier losses themselves. The U.S. Navy, which covered the invasion of Okinawa, sustained severe damage. Japanese suicide pilots, kamikazes, in an exhibition of mass harakiri for their good God Emperor, crashed their bomb-laden planes onto the decks of the invading fleet. All told, the death squad sank over 30 ships and badly damaged scores more. The atomic bombs. Strategists in Washington were meanwhile planning an all-out invasion of the main islands of Japan, an invasion that presumably would cost hundreds of thousands of Americans and even more Japanese casualties. Tokyo, recognizing imminent defeat, had secretly sent peace feelers to Moscow, which had not yet entered the Far Eastern War. The Americans, having broken the secret Japanese radio codes, knew of these feelers, but bomb-scorched Japan still showed no outward willingness to surrender unconditionally to the Allies. The Potsdam Conference, held near Berlin in July 1945, sounded the death knell of the Japanese. There, President Truman, still new on his job, met in a 17-day parley with Joseph Stalin and the British leaders. The conferees issued a stern ultimatum to Japan: surrender or be destroyed. The American bombers showered the dire warning on Japan in tens of thousands of leaflets, but no encouraging response was forthcoming. America had a fantastic ace up its sleeve. Early in 1940, after Hitler's wanton assault on Poland, Roosevelt was persuaded by American and exiled scientists, notably German-born Albert Einstein, to push ahead with preparations for unlocking the secret of an atomic bomb. Congress, at Roosevelt's blank check request, blindly made available nearly $2 billion. Many military minds were skeptical of this damn professor's nonsense, but fears that the Germans might first acquire such an awesome weapon provided a powerful spur to action. Ironically, Germany eventually abandoned its own atomic project as too costly, and as it happened, the war against Germany ended before the American weapon was ready. In a cruel twist of fate, Japan, not Germany, the original target, suffered the fate of being the first nation subjected to atomic bombardment. What was called the Manhattan Project pushed feverishly forward as American know-how and industrial power were combined with the most advanced scientific knowledge. Much technical skill was provided by British and refugee scientists who had fled to America to escape the torture chambers of the dictators. Finally, in the desert near Alamogordo, New Mexico, on July 16, 1945, the experts detonated the first awesome and devastating atomic device. With Japan still refusing to surrender, the Potsdam threat was fulfilled. On August 6, 1945, a lone American bomber dropped one atomic bomb on the city of Hiroshima, Japan. In a blinding flash of death, followed by a funnel-shaped cloud, about 180,000 people were left killed, wounded, or missing. Some 70,000 of them died instantaneously. 60,000 more soon perished from burns and radiation disease. 2 days later, on August 8th, Stalin entered the war against Japan, exactly on the deadline date previously agreed upon with his allies. Soviet armies speedily overran the depleted Japanese defenses in Manchuria and Korea in a 6-day victory parade. That involved several thousand Russian casualties. Stalin was evidently determined to be in on the kill, lest he lose a voice in the final division of Japan's holdings. Fanatically resisting Japanese, though facing atomization, still did not surrender. American aviators on August 9th dropped a second bomb on the city of Nagasaki. The explosion took a horrible toll of about 80,000 people killed or missing. The Japanese nation could endure no more. On August 10, 1945, Tokyo sued for peace on one condition: that Hirohito, the bespectacled son of heaven, be allowed to remain on his ancestral throne as nominal emperor. Despite their unconditional surrender policy, the Allies accepted this condition on August 14, 1945. The Japanese, though losing face, were able to save both their exalted ruler and what was left of their native land. The formal end came with dramatic force. On September 2, 1945, official surrender ceremonies were conducted by General MacArthur on the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay. At the same time, Americans at home hysterically celebrated VJ Day, Victory in Japan Day, after the most horrible war in history had ended in mushrooming atomic clouds. The Allies' triumph. World War II proved to be terribly costly. American forces suffered some 1 million casualties, about one-third of which were deaths. Compared with other wars, the proportion killed by wounds and disease was sharply reduced, owing in part to the use of blood plasma and miracle drugs, notably penicillin. Yet heavy though American losses were, the Soviet allies suffered casualties many times greater, perhaps 20 million people killed. America was fortunate in emerging with its mainland virtually unscathed. Two Japanese submarines using shells and bombers had rather harmlessly attacked the California and Oregon coast, and a few balloons, incendiary and otherwise, had drifted across the Pacific. But that was about all. Much of the rest of the world was utterly destroyed and destitute. America alone was untouched and healthy, oiled and muscled like a prized bull, standing astride the world's ruined landscape. This complex conflict was the best fought war in America's history. Though unprepared for it at the outset, the nation was better prepared than for the others, partly because it had begun to buckle on its armor about a year and a half before the war officially began. It was actually fighting German submarines in the Atlantic months before the explosion in the Pacific at Pearl Harbor. In the end, the United States showed itself to be resourceful, tough, adaptable, able to accommodate itself to the tactics of an enemy who is relentless and ruthless. American military leadership proved to be of the highest order. A new crop of war heroes emerged in brilliant generals like Eisenhower, MacArthur, and Marshall, Chief of Staff, and in imaginative admirals like Nimitz and Spruance. President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill, as kindred spirits, collaborated closely in planning strategy. "It is fun to be in the same decade with you," FDR once cabled Churchill. Industrial leaders were no less skilled, for marvels of production were performed almost daily. Assembly lines proved as important as battle lines, and victory went into the side with most smokestacks. The enemy was almost literally smothered by bayonets, bullets, bazookas, and bombs. Hitler and his Axis co-conspirators had chosen to make war with machines, and the ingenuous Yankees could ask for nothing better. They demonstrated again, as they had in World War I, that the American way of war was simply more men, more weapons, more machines, more technology, and more money than any enemy could hope to match. From 1940 to 1945, the output of American factories was simply phenomenal. As Winston Churchill remarked, "Nothing succeeds like excess." Hermann Göring, a Nazi leader, had sneered, "The Americans can't build planes, only electric iceboxes and razor blades." Democracy had given its answer as the dictators, despite long preparation, were overthrown and discredited. It is true that an unusual amount of direct control was exercised over the individual by the Washington authorities during the war emergency, but the American people preserved their precious liberties without serious impairment.